Welcome back, WNST and Baltimore Positive. We are here in the beautiful Ville in the 21228, and we're doing a special happy hour edition of the program today. Don Moeller has set this up, and this is how ignorant I was to not just the legend of Westmore, because the other Westmore I know and all that, but I thought, like, man, this is unbelievable. Wes is in town for a couple days. We've sandwiched him in on one of these Damien O'Doherty 48-hour benders coming in from Aspen or the Bronx. And then I find out, like, you live up the street, so, I mean, it's still special to have you. But, you know, op-eds and all
coming home to see the kids.
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, you're like, it's not like welcome. Like, you live here. You're like one of us. So,
it's
like,
base,
Baltimore Positive is like, you are top to bottom. You're what I'm talking about. You're what I'm selling. I'm selling Baltimore Positive. That's it. Thank you so much for making some time and coming out to State Fair. I've already had the shrimp and grits. I've already had the Thai chili wings. You've already identified all the celebrities on the wall.
Yes.
And you really were a little embarrassed that you didn't get Chris Cornell perfectly and you didn't get Eddie Vedder. The one that effed me all up. In the back, in the middle, first time I saw it, I thought it was Biz Markie. Just for a second. And he thought that Gwen Stefani was Cindy Lauper, but that's just because he's old.
That's my age, man.
That's just because he's old.
I'm being ganged up on here. Wes, great to have you here.
It's so good to be here. It's so good to be here in Baltimore Positive. And I'm telling you, not only am I a fan, it's important that we highlight the fact that there is a whole lot of positive in Baltimore. So appreciate y'all doing
that. Well, you're a true believer. And Nestor said he's been loading up all day, so I'm going to sort of get out of his way.
Well, Brian Billick always says in his speeches, and, you know, Brian gives the rah-rah, and I've seen him give a million. He's our partner here on behalf of Living Classrooms.
Oh, yeah.
He always says there's chickens and there's pigs in the meal, right? And the chicken's involved, but the pig's committed in the breakfast, you know? And I would always say we're the people. We're committed. We're here. Very early in this journey, we're now almost up to episode 100 with you coming in and being a part of it.
Wow.
And we started with Barbara Mikulski very early on, the Honorable Senator, and she said there's no Superman coming over the hill to save Baltimore. And I think the thing that's very obvious, it's going to be us.
Yeah.
It's going to be us. And not just us who live in the city, us in Pasadena, us in Bel Air, us in here, us in Annapolis, us, the people that live here, that take pride when I'm wearing a shirt that's this fine, you know, when it's this good. So, home, let's start with coming home, because a lot of people know your story and stuff, but you wrote I felt like it was a bad news op-ed to some degree when people were saying to you, why are you coming here? Why do you live in Baltimore is what they say when I get off planes other places. Yeah. Come on, man. Why Baltimore?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, and I love that you talked about the idea of we're not waiting for Superman. You know, Superman and Superwomen, they're already here. They're already around us. They're all over the city. So the question becomes, A, are we continuing to big them up and support them? And then also, B, do we see them in ourselves? Do we understand how powerful we are already as Baltimoreans if we then choose to see what's right with this place? Every morning we wake up and you can make a choice. You can make a choice and you can focus on everything negative if you choose to. And there's enough stuff to point to, right? There's enough stuff that if I wanted to spend every waking hour of the day talking about what's wrong, I could do that.
And some of it you have to focus on in your own life because you have to fix some problems.
Absolutely.
We're all going to wake up with weeds in our garden.
Absolutely.
Literally.
But it was one of the things, and you talk about this idea when I came home because, you know, I, from Baltimore, came up here, was living in New York, but then in really 2014... my wife and I, you know, at the time, and we just had our daughter, and she was now about to be pregnant with our son, and we made the decision. We're like, we want to go home. I want to come back down here, and she's from New York, so this was more like taking her away from her home
and
bringing her back down to mine. And it was amazing because you're right. When I first started asking people, like, I expected New Yorkers not to get it. I expected my New York friends to say,
hey,
what are you doing?
What's better than here?
What's better than here? This is New York.
Forget about it.
Exactly,
it's
right?
The center. Where are you going to be, huh? Take the train anywhere you want to go, huh? Right?
Like, yeah. So I didn't expect them to get it. But what was shocking to me was how many people in Baltimore asked the same question. We're like, why? Like, why are you coming back? Almost as if
you,
like,
got out of here.
Yeah, like you got out. Like, what are you doing? Like,
what is?
And it was amazing to me because it was partially about this idea of we have to understand our own greatness. We have to understand what we have around us. We have to understand that the solutions, that many of the challenges that we have within the city, they have been created and involved in the city, in the history of the city. We understand that. But we also have to understand that the solutions to every single one of those challenges are also here too. And that was what was amazing for me, was that what I was looking for, it can really be summed up in one word. And that word is community. I have a community here. I have a sense of community here. I know Baltimore has my back. And
what was here for you? I mean, because there are people that say, my wife and I were in Maui. Ain't a damn thing I know about in Maui, except it'd be a nice place to be. Right. You know? And if I showed up there, yeah. I wouldn't know anybody, but I'd make friends, you know? Yeah. But people move to places like that. When you moved back here, what was here for you? What becomes foundational that makes it not coming back to a strange place, but coming back to a place that called you? Because you've been all over the world, man. Yeah. I mean, you know, right?
Yeah. And I've loved my experiences all over the world, but none of them have felt like they've really been home to me. Right? Like, I feel like so much of who I am, some of the most important moments in my life, some of the most transformational moments in my life, they happened here. You know, the time from times when I got into my first fight to the time I got my first kiss, they happened here. The time when I first learned to take the train and take buses by myself, they happened here. The time when I first learned that not every street is going to be equal and not every condition, not every time of the night is the right time to walk in the street. I learned them here.
That goes back to education, where you learn so much when you're young. Those are the foundational parts of your life. And if you take that with you, and it sounds like you always had Baltimore in you, that calling it back home. But that is a difficult, that's a family decision, right?
It's a real family decision. And it was a real family decision also because, you know, for my wife at least, she had spent time here, but she hadn't really lived here. So for much of what she understood of Baltimore was the myth of Baltimore.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Did she see The Wire?
She saw The Wire.
See, I haven't seen The Wire yet. I tell Simon that all the time.
You gotta see it.
I work with Simon in the 80s at The Sun, and I don't know, man. I don't want to see that portrayal of my town, you know?
But you know what? I tell you, I think one of the things he did that was so brilliant there was he showed Baltimore for what it is, and he showed Baltimoreans for what we are, which is complex, right? I mean, it wasn't...
Fair enough.
You know, the thing actually I love about The Wire and what he did with The Wire is throughout every single season, there isn't a single person that you see throughout the entire five seasons that is a natural hero or a natural villain. All of them are complex.
Right, you never make... You're not sure about McNulty right to the
end. That's right.
Right, he's a great example.
McNulty is a perfect... McNulty is a amazingly flawed human being.
Right.
Now, McNulty has a lot of heroic qualities.
Right.
And he was an amazingly flawed human being. You could say the same thing about Carcetti.
Right.
You could say the same thing about Avon Barksdale. Where all of them in their own way, they have their archetype, right? They have the person who they're supposed to be and the character they're supposed to take on. But there's nothing perfect about them, and there's nothing completely evil about them either. Like, you understand them. You understand how they got there into complexity. And David did, and I'm telling you, he did an amazing job of being able to pull out the complexity of humanity that he showed within it. It wasn't even so much about the problem of Baltimore. It's about the complexity of humanity.
Well, you know, I haven't even seen it, but I think what you're talking about is the circumstance of where you are and what decisions are available to you.
That's right.
At that moment. What,
that's right.
When you're out in a field with blue and green lights so that people can't see you.
That's right.
The freedoms you had when you're in Times Square are a little different, right?
That's
literally.
Exactly right.
And I, you know, so for you, the circumstances, which is the foundation of your life and the other Westmore and the story that's real, that came to life, that has become your story, the circumstances you talk about, that really is those foundational things and what inspired you to be here and the other Westmore.
Yes. And the circumstances that in some cases you're in control of, and in many cases you're not. Right. In many cases, you are just existing in circumstances that were created long before you arrived, long before you had a say or a choice. You're just existing now in an environment and existing now in a neighborhood or existing in a community that in many ways is almost predestining where you go, which makes that journey that much more complicated.
Now, Wes, you wrote this, the op-ed that Nestor's mentioning. And for those of you listening or watching, go in Google. Wes Moore's op-ed in September in The Sun. Yeah. My recollection is, I don't know if it was planned before it, but it was on the heels of some criticisms of Congressman Cummings by the president.
Yeah.
Was the op-ed in response to those criticisms?
So it was interesting. So what happened was the morning that the president made his comments about Baltimore, I responded, and I normally don't do that. I don't get into Twitter back and forth with anybody, but I responded to his the tweet that he said about Baltimore and that he said about Congressman Cummings, and in this, and I put together like a series of six tweets where basically said, you know, I have to respond here, and I said, you know, the city that you're saying that no one wants to live in, I said that's my home, and that's where I'm raising my children. And I talked about the fact that so much of what he's talking about, that it's difficult to understand the history of Baltimore and where we are currently without understanding the frameworks in which Baltimore, understanding things like blockbusting and redlining and so on and so forth, and also understanding the promise that still lives very much within our society and very much within our cities that you're dismissing. And I defended Congressman Cummings. And what ended up happening was the Baltimore Sun, so it ended up getting retweeted a lot and favored a lot and that kind of thing. And then the Baltimore Sun reached out to me. And that's when they said, you know, we'd like to actually talk with you about it. And they asked the question, they're like, you know, you're running one of the largest poverty fighting organizations in the country. I mean, every year we'll dispense, you know, close to $250 million.
And we're going to spend a whole segment talking about Robin Hood.
And but it's New York based.
Right.
But they said, but you've made a very deliberate decision not to move. That your family is in Baltimore, you are staying in Baltimore, you'd rather take early trains and late trains than move up to New York. And they're like, can you explain why? And I just brought back to one word, and I said, you know, as we talked about, it's like, it's community. And that's when they said, do you mind writing about that? What community means to you?
And well, it came off the page. You know, there were so many points in that made Nestor's really... Nestor's point about community. You talk about, and I think many of us smiled when we feel same connection to our community. You talked about your son going to the barber shop.
Yeah.
What does your son get that? I always wonder if kid does he get the significance that he goes to get his hair cut where dad got his hair cut?
You know, it's not yet. Now all he knows now is that he's going to go hang out with Uncle D.
Right.
And Uncle D is the one who cuts his hair. Uncle D is always the one who has always cut his hair. You know, he laughs about the fact that I was like, I used to have to get my hair cut. Now I just go to the barbershop just to hang out with him.
Yeah. He goes, Dad, you got your haircut.
You got your haircut.
Well,
they used to cut my hair.
Well, maybe this is, you know, where it gets a little deeper. You talk about your mother and sending you off to school, and people don't know the story. I guess we can go through that, and you can tell you have a Jamaican mom from the mountains near where Bob Marley's from.
That's right.
Rob Marley's middle name is Nesta.
Nesta.
So right. So
there you go.
Every time I'm in Jamaica, I get massive respect. You know what I'm saying? So, and you had a hard charging mom that was going to make you be straight or else, or literally or else.
Yeah.
That you had that, and look, we've heard masculine love, feminine love, parents, two parent households, two parents of the same gender. We have all of that. But having someone, you talk about community, but then that child goes home, the community's also enveloping children.
Yeah.
Talk about your childhood, what you had, and what you want for your children, because you want it here in Baltimore, not in Colorado, not in some fantasy island or some place, you know, you got enough money, you can afford to live wherever you wish, in some gated community, whatever, wherever you're here. Yeah. And
It's, you know, it's such a good question because, I mean, when I think about what I want from my kids, you know, I want them to be safe and secure, and I want them, you know, I always dream that I never want my kids to grow up and ever have to see some of the things that I had to see coming up, right? I never want them to have to feel some of the things I had to feel, you know, experience some things I had to experience. At the same time, I want them to know that while the world doesn't revolve around them, the world doesn't exist without them. Like that they have a role to play in all this. And someone once said to me that I thought was a really nice way of putting it. He said, I never want my kids to grow up hungry like I did, but I want my kids to grow up hungry like I did.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I thought that was such a
have enough, but not
way.
Too much.
Not too much. Like, I want you to fight. I want you to work. I want you to know that this is not something where you win no matter what. I want you to know that if you do not put in the work, you don't win. If you don't do what you need to do, you will lose.
But your story is a much more hard scrabble one than even Don, who was raised in a one-parent household, or I was adopted by older parents and had all sorts of crazy stuff going on.
Yeah.
Yours was, you were forced, literally military
you're
style.
You're going to make it.
Right.
Right, Mom? Yeah. You're going to make it, yeah. Westmore.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Which gets me.
What got into her about that? What made that? Because not every mother thinks they feel that way,
yeah.
But not every mother is willing to say, I'm going to send your ass off the military. Yeah, that's
true.
That's it. It's not to get rid of you. It's to fix you because I'm done. Because your mother probably was at wit's end. I mean, all of us made our parents crazy, right? All of us did stuff our parents did.
But I think it also goes back to the fact that I think about how circumstance plays into all that, right? So, like, for example, the fact that my mother even knew about military school was because at church, one of the people she went to church with sent her son to military
and fixed
school.
Him.
And fixed him. Right. And so my mother's like looking at me, and I'm like, first time I felt handcuffs on my wrist was when I was 11 years old. Kicked out of my first school when I was like nine.
But her threat to you was military school, right?
Like it that, was. But that the threat was... started coming at like eight.
So go back to that story, Wes. Pick up on that. You got handcuffs at, what, 11 you
at
said?
At 11. That was the first
What'd
time
you
I
do?
Handcuffs.
Okay.
That one was for
first off,
vandalism.
Did you actually do something?
No,
okay, fair enough.
I wasn't one of these people like, no,
nah,
I never
lie
did
to me.
It.
Don was my high school guidance counselor, 1982, when I was 13.
All right, now,
don't lie
I want
to me.
I want you
right?
to pick up on that story, because I want folks to understand what you were going through at that time and what mom,
11 years old.
Mom's reaction.
Yeah. Where are you when this happens? You're in Baltimore?
No, I'm in the Bronx now.
Oh,
I'm in the Bronx.
Oh,
so,
wow, all right.
So my father died. He actually died in front of us when I was just about 4 years old. And we stayed down here for a little bit longer.
Is that something you talk about, or is that something you not talk about?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, it's...
You can't just roll, not with me. You just
I know.
Well, my father died, and I was there, and we're just going to move...
No.
I'm going to give you some space to talk about that if you wish to.
No, absolutely. And so in fact, I only have really two memories of him. And the first was when I was fighting my older sister, and my mother... had a bunch of rules, but one of her big rules was that men do not put their hands on women, and it's because of her own past. So she's a survivor of domestic violence, and so she always said, I won't tolerate it if I see it. I will not tolerate it if I see it in my son. And so when she'd see me fighting my older sister, it was always my fault. So she would see us fighting, and she would grab me, and she'd be like, you do not put your hands on women. You do not put your hands on women. And I remember one time I was fighting my older sister, and I turned around and I punched her. And as soon as I connected, I turned and I saw my mom. And I was like, oh, it's about
not
to
good.
Get real bad. So she's sprinting after me. And I'm sprinting
that's not a
in
rule.
The other direction.
That's a law.
That's a law.
That's
I
a
broke
law.
A law in that house that day.
That's a law.
And so then I run to my room. And the room that we're in was basically a closet that they turned into a bedroom. So this bedroom that I was in had a small bed for me and a crib for my baby sister, who was a year and a half at the time. And I'm trying to find a place to hide. There's no place to hide in this room. And my father walked into the room. And he really spared me.
That's a religion.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Mom's a law, dad's the religion.
Dad's a religion. But he spared me. Because had it been her, it would have been a very painful day. But he came in, and he sat down, and he started explaining to me what I had done so wrong. And he told me I had to go apologize to my mother and to my sister, and he took me with him. And the thing I remember most about that moment, actually, was because he was a big guy and how my whole hand wrapped around two of his fingers. And he took me to go, I had to go apologize. And the only other memory I have of him was about 6 months later when he died in front of me and all of us. And so this was a person who, like my father was my hero. Like, he was the person I copied. My mom used to laugh, say, like, because he used to walk kind of funny with his chest out. So she's like, you were 4 years old with your chest out. Because, I mean, everything he did was, that was my model. That was what I wanted to be. And my mom, and as difficult as I thought I had it after he died, or as difficult as I thought my sisters had it, the person who really had it toughest was my mom. Because now she was a widow in her 20s with three kids, and she was going to raise these kids on her own.
From Jamaica.
From Jamaica.
Immigrant.
Yes. And he was the one working. He was the main breadwinner. He was doing all this. So she's like, I've got three children, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do now.
And this is 1980.
This was 80. Something. So 80. So it was like 1983. So okay. We're talking.
You're 5 years old.
5 years old in the middle of crazy times. We're talking. This is like the real inception of the whole crack era that started kicking off. We weren't in a good neighborhood. She's having a difficult time, and then finally she called up her parents, my grandparents, who were living up in the Bronx. And my grandfather was a minister in the South Bronx. My grandmother was a school teacher in the South Bronx. And she called them up one day and she said, I need help. And they told her and they gave her the answer she was hoping they would give, which is send the kids up here and we can help out. And so that's what she did. So probably about a month later, we packed up and she drove us up to New York to go live with my grandparents. And that was how I first got introduced to New York. That was how I first got introduced to the Bronx.
And trouble, apparently.
And trouble. Because honestly, it was so amazingly confusing to me. Like, I didn't understand anything. I didn't understand why I had to leave the only place I'd known as home. I was finally to the point now that I understand that my dad wasn't coming back. You know, in fact, my mother tells a story. She's like, at his funeral, my Uncle Vin took me up to go see his body for the final time, how they lay in the casket. And here I am. I'm four and a half years old. And I'm looking in the casket, and I said to him, I said to my father, I said, are you coming with us? So I didn't even fully understand what was going on. I'm thinking he's like laying inside of there sleeping or something. And so as I'm moving up to New York, I'm now living in a new place, in a new environment, in a crazy environment. And in where I'm still like trying to figure out my own path and my own place and my own role. And
were there services available, you know, when you first started getting in trouble? Were there somebody there to help you or punish you? Like, just yeah. From a human services standpoint, when 11 years old, you got handcuffs on.
Yeah.
What then happens to you to try to help you? Anything? Was it? And I would hope that 35 years later, our society has something better than that. I don't know that we do. I am told we don't. I know the result isn't as good.
Yeah.
You know, even and I hope that we have success stories. But what is for that child other than more trouble?
Well, so
other than a mother that sends him off to a military school,
right? I mean, we do have a collection of services and supports that we have in place. And frankly, I think about, for example, I think about that one time, right, where I sit there and I'm sitting in the back of a police car in handcuffs with my friend sitting right next to me in handcuffs. But something actually important happened to me that day. Was the cops were talking outside. They came back in. They were sitting in the front while we were sitting in the back, and they started talking to us about, you know, how we should make different choices and this and that.
Bronx cops giving you the guidance counselor.
Giving the guidance counselor, right? Sure.
Fair enough. You're 11 years old.
While I'm sitting there with my hands behind my back.
You're not the first 11-year-old they had in the back seat.
That's exactly
right. They
want
to scare the hell out of you so that it's the last time.
That's exactly right. So after they're done lecturing us, and my friend is popping off with the mouth, and I'm trying to tell him, yo, please be quiet. Like, I think something good might happen here if you just stop talking.
Right.
And then finally, they eventually get up, and they undo the cuffs, and they let us go. So here's thing number one that happened that was important that day. They didn't criminalize me because they easily had every justification
to
under the law
you, right?
To fingerprint me,
sure.
To send me down, and then to have, now I got to go get picked up by my mom. Now I got to do this. Now I have a juvenile record. Now I have to go to trial. They had every authority in the world to do
it. To mess your family's life up even more.
That's exactly
and
right.
And your family was already on the struggle.
That's exactly right. And they didn't. Right? So that moment was actually an important moment because they made the choice not to criminalize something that was just childish juvenile behavior. And that was an important choice for them to make because that situation, that moment could have changed everything. And they didn't let it. Now, the other thing that I think does become important, though, is it does become the question of what do we see in our kids when we see them? And this goes back to something, you know, when you know, we were talking about this, this story with the other Wes Moore, and I remember having a conversation with him, and we were talking about Baltimore. And this is when I think he was in year three of his life sentence. And I asked him a question, and I said, do you think that we're products of our environments? Because I heard that so many times growing up, that people are products of their environments, they're products of their environments. And so I just kind of swallowed it and accepted it. And he said something to me that day that I will never, ever forget. He just looked back at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. Mm. And as soon as he said it, I thought to myself, he is absolutely right. That we weren't products of our environments, we're products of our expectations. And someone once said to me, it's a real shame that you lived up to your expectations and Wes didn't. And I said, the real shame is we both did.
We both
lived up to our expectations. We both ended up exactly where we thought we would at some point. And wow. That's why I think that the question is so powerful, because it does go back to what is it that we see when we look at our children. The expectations that they have for themselves, it doesn't come from nowhere. Because the expectations they have of themselves come from the expectations that we have of them. And they internalize them and they make them their own. And so I think for me at some point, you know, it wasn't just about the fact that, you know, when people say, well, military school was great because you got disciplined, or military school was great because they made you do push-ups and they made you wake up early. All that's true. Got disciplined, they made me wake up early, they made me do a lot of push-ups. But you know what it also did? It helped to change the expectations that I have for myself. And that changed my mentality, and that changed my behavior, and that changed my prospects.
Break. That's where we stop. We come back. We're going to dive more into the other Westmore.
We'll fix the light in here, man. It's our first happy hour. Well, no, we did one with Dick Gass, but Westmore is here, the other Westmore.
This was going to be special.
There's another Nestor Aparicio on fact.
There is. We're going to find him for the end of the show.
I found him. Don Moeller is here from a Baltimore County executive. We're doing Baltimore Positive. We're at State Fair. I've already had the shrimp and grits, the wings. I'm probably going to stick around long enough and shut out the lights and get the chicken and waffles. We're back for more. We're going to be at Jennings soon. We're at Fadley's next week with Thoreau Vignaraja. We have all sorts of great stuff going on, including more with Westmore right after this.